Chapter 27. Webb and Romano had given their statements about three times each, and Bates had come down and had taken a bite out of Webb's butt for conducting an unauthorized investigation.
"I told you they'd be gunning for you, Webb. But you stubborn son of a bitch, you just won't listen," ranted Bates.
"Hey, take it easy," said Romano.
"Do I know you?" said Bates, as he got right in Romano's face. "Pla Romano, hotel team assaulter." He put out his hand.
Bates ignored the gesture and turned back to Webb.
"Do you realize that Buck Winters is looking for any excuse to squash you?"
He glanced at Romano.
"To officially cremate all of HRT? And you're playing right into his hands."
"All I'm trying to do is find out what happened to my guys," rejoined Webb. "And you'd be doing the same thing if you were me."
"Don't you throw that bullshit in my face."
Bates stopped cold because Webb was holding up the newspaper clipping.
"I found this in the house."
Bates slowly reached out and took the clipping.
"You want to talk about it?" asked Webb.
Bates led them away from the crime scene and over to a quiet slice of ground. He glanced at Romano and then at Webb.
"He's okay," said Webb. "Cleared for all sorts of top secret stuff."
"Even did joint VIP protection on Arafat once," said Romano. "Now you talk about a target. Lots of people after that man."
"You didn't mention you were working with Cove when his family was killed," said Webb.
"I don't owe you my life story," snapped Bates.
"Maybe you just owe me an explanation."
Bates folded the clipping up and put it in his pocket.
"It was really nobody's fault. Cove didn't mess up, and we didn't either. It was a fluke, and the Russians got lucky. I wish I could take it back, but nobody can. Randy Cove is a hell of an agent."
"So Cove has no reason to be seeking payback?"
"No. I've talked to him. He almost got popped not that long after Charlie team. He said he saw that building filled to the brim with everything that was supposed to be there."
"So his story is he got set up to feed us bad intel. Out went the files and in came the guns," said Webb.
"Something like that. It was a short-time fuse. Cove said he was in the building shortly before you guys hit it. He thought he'd infiltrated a big-time drug op."
"Purse, I'm not looking to tell you how to do your job, but the smart thing may be to bring him in. With his cover blown, he sounds like he needs protection."
"Cove can take care of himself. And he can do more on the outside. In fact, he might be getting close to a big-time drug supplier."
"That I don't care about. All I want are the guys who set us up."
"That's just it, Webb. They might be one and the same."
"Well, that doesn't make a lot of sense. Why would a drug supplier want to have the Bureau coming after them loaded for bear?"
"There could be any number of reasons. Paybacks, to keep distributors in line, even to set up a rival to take the heat and reduce the competition."
"You let me have a crack at those guys," said Romano, "and I'll reduce something like their lifespan."
"So I take it he's not reporting in regularly," said Webb.
"How'd you know that?" said Bates.
"If he's really that good, he'll know that everybody thinks he's in on it. So he lies low, doesn't trust anybody, and goes about his own investigation, trying to get to the truth before somebody gets him."
"That's a pretty good deduction."
Webb said, "Actually, I'm just speaking from experience."
"Speaking of experience, I finally got a call back from Bill Canfield. I've got an appointment to meet him tomorrow at his farm. Care to join me?"
"I said I would. You want to come too, Pauly?"
Bates stared at him.
"Are you the same Paul Romano that was with Delta Force and then New York SWAT?"
"There's only one Paul Romano," said Romano, without a trace of conceit.
"Arafat, huh?"
"Hey, when you want to send the very best."
"Good. Consider yourself temporarily reassigned. I'll talk to your commander."
Romano looked stunned.
"Reassigned doing what?"
"Doing what I tell you to do. See you two tomorrow."
Webb dropped off Romano at home. Before he got out, Romano said, "Hey, Webb, you think this new gig pays more? Angie's been talking about getting a new washer-dryer and maybe finishing the basement."
"If I were you, I wouldn't mention anything like that to Angie. You'll be lucky if it doesn't pay less."
Romano shook his head as he got out.
"Story of my life."
Webb pulled away and drove aimlessly. He felt miserable about Chris Miller and didn't envy the people who would have to tell his wife. He hoped Miller didn't have any kids, but he looked like the kind who would. Damn, there was just too much misery in the world. Finally, he decided he needed another dose of old-fashioned police work. Webb took the outer loop of the Capitol Beltway around to Interstate 395, headed north, and steered the Mercury Bates had gotten for him across the dilapidated 14th Street Bridge that an airplane taking off from National Airport in a snowstorm had actually fallen on years ago. He pointed the car toward an area of town where few law-abiding citizens, other than those who were lost or those who carried a gun and a badge, ever dared venture, especially at this hour. The scene was a familiar one to Webb. It was the same route his squad had followed on their last night on Earth. Webb knew the car and its government plates just screamed Fed Man, but he really didn't care. For an hour, he cruised up and down every dead-end street, every alley, every hole in the wall that looked promising. Several times, he passed patrol cars that were nosing around looking for trouble, which here was akin to being a cat in an aviary. What you wanted was damn near everywhere. He was just about to give it up when his gaze caught on the flash of red under a streetlight. He slowed the car, grabbed his trusty binoculars from the bag, and got a better look. It was probably nothing, for many wore the do-rag here, and many of them were red. Red for blood. Even people down here had a sense of purpose and also humor about their work. A few seconds later, Webb's pulse kicked to a higher gear. The gent was even wearing the same clothes, a tank shirt over barbell shoulders and shorts below the butt crack. It was his good old neighborhood purveyor of fine crack cocaine and other illegal drugs from the alley where Charlie Team had run its last lap. Webb cut the car's engine, let the car drift to a stop, and quietly got out. He thought about taking his shotgun, but then decided his pistol would be enough. It was hard to pounce holding a shotgun. He gripped his pistol and slowly made his way down the street, keeping to the shadows. There was a streetlight under which he had to pass on his way to the kid. Just when he stepped into its pool of light, there came a scream from somewhere. The kid looked up, saw him. Webb swore under his breath and took off running.
"Still want a deal on my rifle?" Webb called out to him as he hustled forward.
The kid bolted down the alley. Webb knew he shouldn't do it, not even armed, and he stopped. Going down that alley without any backup, he might as well phone in his casket order. It was still a tough decision, because Webb wanted Bandana Boy in the worst sort of way. In Webb's connect-the-dots manner of thinking, maybe Bandana was the one who hit the remote that had activated the laser, that had tripped the machine guns, that had sent Webb's dearest friends into oblivion. He finally made up his mind.
"Another night, my friend. And next time, I won't stop until my hands are around your damn neck."
Webb turned to go back to his car. That's when he saw them coming. They seemed in no hurry. There were maybe a dozen of them. Along with their elongated shadows against the brick, he saw the array of weapons they were carrying. Cut off from his car, Webb ducked down the alley and started running hard. He heard the group behind him do the same.
"Shit," he said to himself. "Could anybody say set up?"
The light from the street lamp was quickly left behind, and Webb could only rely on the presence of some dregs of ambient light from the sky and the sounds of running feet ahead and behind him. Unfortunately, in this high-walled labyrinth, the echoes were not reliable guides.
Webb made lefts and rights until he was hopelessly lost. He turned one last corner and stopped. He imagined half the group had probably headed around to block his escape, though for all he knew, he was running in circles. He thought he could still hear them coming, but he couldn't tell from where. He ducked down another alley and stopped. Listened. Quiet. Quiet he didn't like. Quiet meant stealth. He looked left, right, and then up. Up. Up sounded good. He climbed a nearby fire escape and then froze. The footsteps were close. He soon saw why. Two of them came around the corner. They were tall, lean, with shaved heads and dressed in leather and baggy, low-riding prison shuffle jeans and big jailhouse shoes with thick heels they were no doubt just itching to grind into Webb's face. They halted and looked around. They were directly underneath him. Just like Webb had done, they looked left and then right. He figured it would only be a matter of seconds before, as he had done, they looked up. So he swung down, and each foot collided with one head, and both men slammed into the brick wall. Webb landed a little awkwardly, his ankle twisting under him. Since each husky fellow was groaning and attempting to get up, he landed the butt of his pistol against the backs of their necks, and they went down for a long winter's nap. He grabbed their guns, threw them all into a dumpster standing nearby, and then sprinted off. He could still hear running feet and also an occasional gunshot. Webb didn't know if it was his pursuers or simply your run-of-the-mill gangbanger dispute that happened around here every night. He rounded another corner and was hit low and hard. The impact knocked him off his feet, and he lost his weapon as he sprawled on the asphalt. He rolled and came up, fists cocked. Bandana Boy was standing there, a knife almost as big as he was in hand. He was grinning the same shit-eating grin that he'd had in the alley on the night that Charlie Team had disappeared. Webb noted he held the weapon with some skill. The kid probably had fought 100 knife fights. He was shorter than Webb, yet more muscular, probably quicker. This was to be a classic test of youth against experience. "Well, come on and eat some experience, young man," muttered Webb as he prepared to defend himself. The kid lunged at Webb, whipping the knife blade around so fast Webb could hardly follow. Yet he didn't really have to, because Webb executed a loop kick that clipped Bandana's legs out from under him, and he went down hard. The kid was up quickly, but only in time to take one of Webb's size 12s to the head. With the kid stunned, Webb was all over him. He locked down the arm holding the knife and proceeded to break Bandana's grip on both the knife and his forearm. With his security of the blade gone and a jagged shaft of his forearm staring him in the face, the kid fled, his cries of pain sweeping the alley with him and his shit-eating attitude lying next to the knife on the bloody ground. Webb shook his own fuzzy head clear and started to stumble over to retrieve his gun. He never made it. Webb could only watch silently as the group of men appeared from all corners, blocking the path to his weapon. They carried sawed-off shotguns and pistols. Webb could sense they were all so very happy to see him here, outnumbered as he was 10-1. Webb figured he had nothing to lose by taking an aggressive posture. He held out his FBI shield. "I could bust every one of you on weapons charges, but I tell you what, I'm feeling generous and not up to all the paperwork, so you just pack up and go about your business and we'll forget about it. For now. But don't be pulling this shit again." Their response was to move forward. Webb's response to that was to move back until he felt the wall behind him, and further retreat and ultimate escape would have to be confined to his imagination. Then two of the crew directly in front of him were tossed to the side so violently it was like gravity had been suspended from underneath them. In this gap, Webb found himself staring up at the largest man he had ever seen outside a professional football game. The giant was 6'6" or 7, and if he carried less than 400 pounds on his frame, Webb didn't know how. He realized that this new antagonist must be the legendary Big F. The man was dressed in a short-sleeved, burgundy-colored silk shirt that was so large, Webb could have used it for a blanket. Beige linen pants covered long legs that actually looked short, so thick and massive were they. He had on no socks, his bare feet were in suede loafers, and his shirt was open to the navel, even though it was only about 50 degrees, with a sneaky little breeze that quickly got under one's skin. His skull had a shadow of fuzz covering it. His facial features matched his great size, with a heavy blob of nose and conical ears, each pierced with about a dozen diamond studs that gleamed impressively, even in the poor light. He wasted no time and strode right up to Webb. When Big F reached out to grab a fistful of him, Webb delivered a vicious blow to the man's gut that would have dropped a heavyweight boxer. All he got from Big F was a grunt. Then he lifted Webb off the ground, reared back like he was preparing to hurl a shot put, and threw the 200-pound Webb a good 10 feet down the alley. The rest of the gang hooted, cursed, and otherwise had themselves a little federal agent ass-kicking party, high-fiving, exchanging growls, and knuckle-banging each other with animalistic glee. Webb had not even gotten to his feet before the man was on him again. This time he hooked Webb by his belt, lifted him up, and sent him sailing into a line of garbage cans. Webb came up fast, gagging for air and nauseous with the pounding he was taking. Before Big F could get to him, Webb shot forward, lowered his shoulder, and laid his very solid frame directly into the man's gut. Webb might as well have slammed himself into a pickup truck for all the good it did. He dropped to the asphalt without having budged Big F one damned inch. His shoulder felt dislocated. Webb got to his feet, feigned being seriously hurt, and then exploded with a leaping kick that caught Big F flush on the side of the head. Splotches of blood appeared at the corner of Big F's ear, and Webb noted with satisfaction that he had relieved the man of some of his diamond studs, leaving jagged bits of earlobe in their bloody wake. Yet Big F was still standing, like one of the brick buildings surrounding them. Webb had knocked 100-pound body bags right off their supports with that kick. How could this be? Well, he had no time, really, to think about how it could be, because Big F, moving faster than a man his size should ever have been able to, delivered a forearm the size of a 6x6 to the side of Webb's head that came one dizzying star from knocking him out. A few seconds later, Big F was half-carrying and half-dragging Webb down the alley, his shoes and jacket lost somewhere along the way. His pants were ripped, and his legs and arms were bleeding from being dragged over the pavement. Apparently, just for fun, since Webb was putting up no further resistance, Big F tossed him headfirst against a dumpster. This did knock out Webb, and he stayed that way until he felt himself being thrown onto something soft. He opened his eyes. It was the interior of the Mercury. He flinched when he saw Big F slam the door and walk away. The guy hadn't said one word, and Webb had never been more humbled in his life. No wonder Granny and Jerome had acted the way they had. Hell, Jerome was probably still running. Webb sat up slowly and felt around for broken bones. When he opened his right hand, a paper fluttered out of it. Webb saw the numbers and words scribbled on it, looked over in amazement at where Big F had been but was no longer. He put the slip of paper in his pocket, pulled out his keys, revved up the Mercury, and burned rubber off the rear wheels, getting the hell out of there, leaving behind his jacket, his shoes, his pistol, and a big chunk of his confidence. Chapter 28. It was early in the morning, and Webb was soaking in the tub in another crummy motel. Every part of him ached.
The long scrapes on his arms and legs burned like there was a branding iron pressed to them. He had a knot on his forehead from where his noggin had met dumpster, and a gash along the good side of his face that probably still had some grains of asphalt inside. Boy, he was aging really well. He should try out for male modeling when he left the bureau. The phone rang, and Webb swung his hand out and snagged it. It was Bates.
"I'll pick you and your buddy up in an hour at Romano's house."
Webb groaned.
"What's wrong?" asked Bates.
"Late night. Got a bitch of a hangover."
"Oh, I'm so sorry, Webb. 1 hour. Be there or find another planet to live on."
Bates hung up. Exactly 1 hour later, Bates picked up Webb and Romano, and they headed to Virginia horse country. Bates looked at Webb's fresh injuries.
"What the hell happened to you?" asked Bates. "You better not have trashed another car, because after the Mercury, you're riding a bicycle."
Bates glanced over at Webb's car, parked at the curb. "I slipped getting out of the bathtub."
"You did all that getting out of the tub?"
Bates clearly did not believe this. "You know what they say, Purse. Most accidents happen at home." Bates stared at him for a long moment before deciding not to pursue it. He had a lot of other items on his to-do list. After an hour's drive, they got off the highway and drove for miles along twisting roads and hairpin curves bracketed by thick woods. They missed a turn somewhere because they ended up on a dirt road barely wide enough for their car. Webb looked over at a sagging metal gate and the sign next to it that read, "East Winds Farm. No hunting, fishing, or trespassing. Violators prosecuted to the fullest extent of the law." East Winds, they knew, was the name of the Canfield farm. "They must have come in on the rear side," Webb concluded. He smiled as he read the sign. "Well, damn, these people meant business." He was shaking with fear. He glanced at Romano, who was looking at the sign and smiling too, because he was probably thinking the same thing. The fencing here was low, rail board on post. The place was in the middle of nowhere.
"Somebody who knew what they were doing could hop that fence in a second, go to the main house, kill the Canfields and everyone else there, have a drink, watch some TV, and no one would probably know until the spring thaw," opined Romano knowledgeably.
"Yeah, and since murder isn't one of the offenses listed on the sign," added Webb, "I guess he'd be free from prosecution."
"Keep that crap to yourself," growled Bates.
However, Webb could tell the guy was worried. This place was vulnerable. They finally found the correct turn and reached the front entrance to East Winds. The gates reminded Webb of the ones in front of the White House. And yet, with all the exposed property, the big gates were a joke from a security perspective. Above the entrance was an arch of metal scrollwork with the name of the farm written large. And to top it all off, the gates were open. There was a call box, however, and Bates hit the button. They waited and someone finally came on.
"Special Agent Bates with the FBI." "Come on up," said the voice. "Follow the main road and take the first right up to the main house."
As Bates pulled forward, Webb pointed out, "No closed-circuit TV. We could be Charlie Manson and company for all they know." They headed straight. The rolling green land stretched as far as they could see, much of it enclosed by horizontal rail fencing. Large rolls of hay lay in the fields. Off to one side was a small pond. The main road was asphalt and ran straight for a while and then curved right around a swath of towering oak and hickory with scrub pines wedged between. Through the trees to the right, they caught glimpses of an enormous structure. They finally came to a large two-story stone house with high Palladian windows and broad sliding doors below, and topped with a large tin-sheathed cupola patinaed by the elements, with a weather vane of a horse and rider mounted on top. To Webb, it looked like a color Martha Stewart might try to copyright and then sell to the masses as something far more chic than simple weather rot. They turned right, away from the carriage house, and passed down a long paved drive. Some of the largest maple trees Webb had ever seen were situated in rows on each side of the drive, forming a natural roof of limbs and leaves. Webb looked up ahead, and his eyes widened. It was the largest house he had ever seen, and it was constructed all from stone, with an enormous front portico supported by six massive columns. "Damn," said Romano. "That looks to be about the size of the Hoover building." Bates parked the car in front and started to get out.
"It's a house, Romano, and put your tongue back in your mouth and try not to embarrass the bureau."
The massive door opened and a man stood there. Billy Canfield had not aged well, thought Webb. He was still tall and trim, but the broad shoulders and deep chest, which Webb remembered from the man's visits to Webb in the hospital, had fallen in. His hair was now thinner and almost fully gray, and the face had grown even craggier. As Canfield walked out to see them, Webb noted the limp in the man's gait, and he saw where one knee turned inward more than normal. Canfield, he figured, would be in his early 60s now. 15 years ago, he had married for the second time to Gwen, a woman much younger than he was. He had grown children from his first marriage, and he and Gwen had also had their own boy, the 10-year-old who had been killed by members of the Free Society at the school in Richmond. Webb still saw David Canfield's face often in his dreams. The guilt had not lessened over the years. If anything, it had grown more intense. Canfield eyed each of them fiercely from under thick tufts of eyebrows. Bates put out his strong hand and held up his credentials with the other. "Just like the Bureau taught you," observed Webb.
"I'm Agent Bates with the FBI's Washington Field Office, Mr. Canfield. Thanks for letting us come out."
Canfield ignored Bates and instead looked over at Webb.
"I know you, don't I?"
"Webb London, Mr. Canfield. I'm with Hostage Rescue. I was down in Richmond that day," he added diplomatically. "You visited me in the hospital. That meant a lot to me. I want you to know that."
Canfield nodded slowly and then put out his hand to Webb, who shook it.
"Well, I appreciate what y'all tried to do then. You did all you could, risked your life and all for my boy."
He stopped and looked over at Bates.
"But I told you on the phone that nothing's happened out here. And if that son of a bitch comes my way, he'll end up dead and not the other way around." "I understand that, Mr. Canfield." "Billy." "Thank you, Billy. But you have to understand that three people with a connection to what happened at that school in Richmond, and possibly a fourth person, have already been killed. If the Free Society is behind it, and I have to tell you that as yet we have no direct proof that they are, but if they are, you could be a target. That's why we're here."
Canfield looked at his watch.
"And what? You want to put me under lock and key? I got a damn horse farm to run, and let me tell you, it don't run on autopilot." "I understand that, but there are unobtrusive steps we can take." "Y'all want to keep talking, you got to come on with me. I got things to do."
Bates exchanged glances with Webb and Romano and then shrugged. They followed Canfield over to a jet-black Land Rover and climbed in. Canfield didn't wait for seatbelts to be put on. He hit the gas and they sped off. Webb was in the front seat next to him. As they drove along, he surveyed the farm.
"Last I heard, you owned a trucking company in Richmond. How'd you end up on a horse farm in Fauquier County?"
Canfield slipped a cigarette out of his shirt pocket and lit up, cracked the window, and blew smoke out.
"Gwen doesn't let me smoke in the house. Take my shots when I can," he explained. "Now that's a damn good question, Webb. From trucking to horses. I ask myself that sometimes, and sometimes I wish I was back in trucking. I was born and bred in Richmond, and like it there. That city creeps into your bones, for better or worse, and I've seen both sides of that coin. But Gwen's always loved horses. She grew up on a farm in Kentucky. I guess it gets in your blood, too. All it's done for me is make my blood pressure go through the roof. Anyway, we decided to make a go of it. Jury's still out on how we're doing. Sunk every damn dime I have into this place, so at least we have the incentive to make it work.
What exactly do you do on a horse farm? Asked Romano as he leaned forward. See, the only horses I've seen are the ones that pull the carriages around Central Park. I grew up in the Big Apple.
Sorry to hear that, Yank, said Canfield. He looked around at Romano. Didn't catch your name.
Romano, Paul Romano. Friends call me Paulie.
Well, we're not friends, so I'll just call you Paul. Now, the main thing you do on a horse farm is bleed money, Paul. Bleed it like it's ice in a damn hailstorm. You pay out your ass for a property like this and all the people to help run it. You get you some horses and they eat you out of house and home. You pay outrageous stud fees so some son of a bitching horny stallion with a few track victories to its name will impregnate your mares. And then nature delivers you some foals that proceed to chip away at what little money you got left. As the foals grow into yearlings, you spend enough on the little sons of bitches to send a dozen kids to Harvard. And then you hope and pray that maybe one of them shows some promise and you can sell it to some poor sucker and maybe get a 5% return on your money for working your ass off 16 hours a day. And if you don't, then the bank that you've sold your life to comes and takes every single thing you've ever owned in your whole life, and you die dirt poor without a roof over your head, a stitch of clothes on your back, or a single person you could call a friend. He looked back at Romano. That's about it, Paul. You got any other questions?
Nope, that about covers it, said Romano as he sat back.
They reached a compound consisting of barns, stables, and other buildings, and Canfield drove underneath a pediment wooden arch that Canfield said was based upon the one at George Washington's Mount Vernon, only that it cost more.
This is the equestrian center. Horse stalls, big hay barn, manager's office, trainer's work center, wash stalls, riding rings, and the like. God's little acre, if ever there were one, said Canfield, and he laughed as he climbed out of the rover. The FBI agents followed him.
Canfield called out to a man who was talking to a number of what looked to Webb to be farmhands.
Hey, Nemo, come on over here for a sec.
The man walked over. He was about Webb's height, yet burly, with the powerful physique of someone who worked with his body for a living. He had short, wiry black hair, slightly graying at the temples, and strong, handsome features. His clothes were clearly ranch, loose-fitting jeans and a faded denim shirt. Pointed toe boots were on his feet. They weren't fancy, no alligator or kangaroo skin, and no silver toe clips. They were dusty and creased from hard use and worn away where web-figured stirrups met the leather. Muddy canvas gloves stuck out from his back pocket. He took off his sweat-stained Stetson as he walked over and wiped his brow with a rag.
Nemo Straight here is my farm manager. Nemo, this is a bunch of folks from the FBI. They've come here to tell me I'm in danger because they let the asshole that killed my son break out of jail and he might be gunning for me.
Straight gave them all a terrifically unfriendly stare. Webb put out his hand.
I'm Agent Webb London.
Straight shook his hand, and Webb felt the extra force the man gave to the grip. Nemo Straight was a very strong gent and obviously wanted to let Webb know it. Webb caught the man checking out his damaged mug. For most, it evoked sympathy, which Webb loathed. Nemo, though, came away just looking a little surlier, as though he had suffered far greater wounds on a good day. Webb instantly liked the man. Canfield pointed at Webb.
Now this fella here actually tried to save my boy, which is more than I can say for some others involved in the process.
Well, in my opinion, the government's not good for much except messing up folks' lives, said Nemo, looking at Webb.
His voice was pure country, with little dips in between each syllable, mimicking the bobbing of his prodigious Adam's apple. For some reason, Webb envisioned Big Nemo performing country and western karaoke and being just a stitch at it. Webb looked over at Bates, who said,
"What we're trying to do here is help you, Billy. If somebody tries something with you, we want to be here to stop it."
Canfield surveyed his property and then stared at Bates.
"I got 10 men full-time on my farm, and every one of them is pretty good with a gun."
Bates shook his head.
"We waltzed right in here, and you didn't even know who we were. You came out the front door unarmed and alone. If we were looking to kill you, you'd already be dead."
Canfield smiled.
"What if I told you I had some of my boys watching you from the time you stepped on the property? And that they were pointing something at you that wasn't their fingers?"
Webb and Romano glanced around without seeming to do so. Webb had a sixth sense about people aiming guns his way, and he was wondering why it hadn't kicked in.
"Then I'd tell you your boys probably would end up shooting some innocent people," said Bates. "Well, hell, that's what I got insurance for, I guess," Canfield shot back. "I checked the records, Billy. During the trial, you received death threats from Ernest Free, among others. The Bureau put you under protection then."
Canfield's features grew very grim.
"That's right. Every time I turned around, there was some suit with a gun staring at me and reminding me that my little boy was dead and buried. So no offense, but I've had enough of you folks to last the rest of my life. That's about as clear as I can make it."
Bates squared his shoulders and got closer to Canfield.
"The Bureau is offering you protection again. And until Ernest Free is caught, and we're sure that you're not in danger, I'm kind of insisting on it," added Bates.
Canfield folded his arms across his chest.
"Well, then we got us a problem, because this is the United States of America, and a person has the right to choose who comes on his property and who doesn't. And I'm asking you to get the hell off my land right now."
Strait moved closer to his boss, and Webb saw some of the other farmhands also draw nearer. He also noted that Romano's hand had eased to his pistol grip. One big fellow made the truly enormous mistake of putting his hand on Romano's shoulder. In an instant, the man was face down on the ground, Romano's knee against the base of his spine, 145 in the guy's ear, and another 45, which Romano had pulled from the second holster he wore on the back of his waistband, pointed at Canfield's other men.
"Okay," said Romano. "Any of you other buckaroos want to bring it on?"
Webb quickly stepped forward before Romano killed them all.
"Look, Billy, I shot 2 of the Frees, and if I had gotten the chance, I would have blown Ernest away, too. But the bastard got lucky and took a round through his shoulder instead, and I walked out with half a face and missing most of my blood. Now, I really believe that we all want the same thing here. We're just differing a bit on how to get there. What if Romano and I came to stay with you on the farm? No suits, just jeans and boots. We'll even help with the work. But in exchange, you have to cooperate with us. You'll have to listen to us when we tell you there might be a problem, and if we tell you to get your butt down, you get down. It looks like the Frees have already taken out several people, and they did it in ways that were pretty damn ingenious. So while I'm sure your men are really good at what they do, it might not be enough if these people really want to take you out. I can see that you're not the sort of guy who likes other people to tell you what to do, but I also don't believe you want to give the Frees the satisfaction of killing you. You and your wife have already been through that hell with your son. I don't believe you want her to have to grieve again over you."
Canfield looked at Webb a long moment, and for that entire time, Webb wasn't sure if the man was going to jump him or maybe order his men to open fire.
Finally, Canfield looked down and kicked the dirt.
Let's go on back to the house and talk about this.
He motioned for Strait and his men to go back to work. Romano helped the man up and even dusted him off.
Nothing personal, Slick. I would have done that to anybody who touched me. Get the message?
The man grabbed his hat and hustled off. From the look of fear in the man's eyes, Webb didn't think he'd be touching Romano ever again. Canfield and the agents climbed in the Rover. As they were driving back, Canfield looked over at Webb.
Okay, I'm not disputing that what you say makes a lot of sense, but I'm not looking forward to revisiting that part of my life. And I'm kind of hating it that these assholes are pulling me back into that shithole.
I understand that, but... Webb was interrupted by the ringing of his cell phone. He checked his phone, but it wasn't his. Bates and Romano did the same thing. Canfield pulled a phone out of a storage panel in the Rover and looked at it. It wasn't ringing. He glanced at the floorboard and reached down and picked up the phone that was lying there.
Somebody must have left their phone in here, although it's not Gwen's and I don't know who the hell else drives this truck. Probably somebody wanting to sell me something.
He was about to punch the talk button when Webb grabbed the phone out of his hand, hit the window button on his door, and threw the phone out. Canfield looked at him.
What in the hell do you think you're doing?
They watched as the phone flew through the air and then hit the ground in the middle of an empty dirt field. Nothing happened. Canfield pulled the Rover to a stop.
You get your ass out there and go get that damn phone.
The explosion was powerful enough to rock the Land Rover and send a cloud of black smoke and flames 100 feet in the air. All the men stared at this fiery spectacle for several seconds. Finally, a shaken Canfield looked over at Webb.
When do you boys want to start?